I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by Sean Starowitz. He's an artist and provocateur. Do you mind if I call you a provocateur?
Sure.
He runs the Talk Shop on 39th and Main, and he's just co-written an article about a concept known as creative placemaking. And Sean, before we hear your critique of creative placemaking, why don't you go ahead and explain what it is?
Yeah, sure. So creative placemaking is this thing. So it started originally with Project for Public Spaces called Placemaking Initiatives, which is kind of an integrative design tactic to use planners and neighborhoods and to kind of create these kind of holistic approaches of neighborhood revitalization, so to speak.
And do I remember right that this was connected with Richard Florida and the rise of the creative class, or just sort of in tandem?
That kind of came later. So placemaking kind of got hybridized by this new group, and then creative placemaking was thrown on the forefront of that, which was to integrate artists into the process. So yeah, there's this kind of argument about the Richard Floridian kind of appropriation of placemaking, which Project for Public Spaces actually does some pretty interesting work, while some creative placemaking projects now have kind of led to gentrification, displacement, kind of using artists as predatorial real estate practice.
So I guess, you know, one of the issues you raise is that, in your view, artists are sort of used in the process of city revitalization. Cities cash in on what you call a quirk factor, turning the messiness of creativity into something tidy and marketable. And then the artists get thanked by being priced out. Is that the argument?
Yeah. Basically, I mean, the problem that arises is that there isn't necessarily neighborhood buy-in always, because in cities, there's, you know, the underclass or the working poor, which are usually not brought to the table in these kind of conversations because property values are so cheap. Then a developer will kind of come in and start to kind of buy up property and then bring in this kind of predatorial kind of approach of kind of investment into land practices. And artists get roped up into that unwillingly, maybe, possibly, or willingly.
So, yeah, that brings me to this more, I would say, like a really unique part of your criticism, which has to do with what you call a colonial idea that anyone who just appears on the scene is actually doing something like making a place, as though it was not a place until you arrived and made it something.
Yeah, I mean, place is a really challenging word in the English language because it has so many different kind of connotations. So, you know, place also has a historical, political sphere, which is like knowing a woman's place or knowing your place, owning parcels of land. So there's a political edge to it. So yeah, one of my major criticisms is by saying, oh, we're going to creatively place make, you're saying that there's not a history, there's not a narrative that's already in that space. And it goes back to this kind of Neil Smith argument called the New Urban Frontier, which is this frontier mentality that we had when we had westward expansion. In the United States is the same thing we have in cities, where it's this kind of, the inner city is kind of seen as uncivil, quote unquote. And so it's this idea that we can kind of colonialize by just kind of pushing out the same way we treated the westward expansion.
So in this picture, who is taking whose place? Because the artist is sort of, it seems like maybe at once in this argument, taking someone else's place and then being ready to be taken over.
Well, it's complicated. I think in post-industrial sized cities like Kansas City, we have an issue that real estate is really affordable in the inner city, right? So artists are a part of the working class, sometimes not always, but what you have to understand too is that art and capital are inherent in this system. So you kind of need artists to kind of be a part of that, as well as the working class, because that's, you know, part of the reasons why the neighborhoods are so affordable for developers to kind of come in and gobble up. So for me, it's about this issue of like, how do we kind of create these more holistic kind of approaches? And so artists necessarily, like there's an argument that is used to kind of give some imagery, and I said this on the show a couple weeks ago, that artists are the gazelle and that artists are the lion, you know, and then the developers are the lions.
I want to turn to another major player in Kansas City's art scene for her perspective on this. Pat Jordan is best known for leading the revival of the Gem Theater on 18th and Vine. She now runs a gallery, the Vine Street Studio, and she's transformed a vacant house on the east side into an art space, too. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
So you, given your experience, I am so curious about your thoughts as you listen to Sean.
The whole discussion about gentrification is curiously interesting to me. It requires, I think, well, going back to something that Sean was talking about in terms of assigning definitions to a particular word, when we talk about gentrification, we tend to kind of focus in on too narrowly on the word itself, I think. And we as a society need to understand that when we start conversations about a particular issue, there are different layers. There are so many layers of discussion that need to take place. And so my first response is basically that we're talking about community development. And when you talk about community development, it's a whole course of work and not a few minute conversation.
How do you see your role? I mean, talk to me first of all about Key Coalition. That's the neighborhood where you've brought art to a vacant house.
And we're in the process of doing that. We're in the process of rehabbing the house. The first introduction to Key Coalition came with my realization that I needed to do more and explore better how it is that I could take art to the neighborhoods. I never have wanted to go into a neighborhood in a dictatorial manner, assuming that I knew what was best for the neighborhood. What I always advise is what I did, which was to ask that particular neighborhood what its needs were. And so my involvement has gone in steps. The first step was to assist with an arts walk. Or a walk run, and we turned it into a walk run and arts walk. The second phase was then going about identifying a house that we could turn into an arts house, and we are currently working on that. The third phase was being invited to, as a consultant, help with a community center that's currently being built at 27th and Prospect. So my involvement has gone in phases over years, fueled by a passion.
What about vacancy in Kansas City? I mean, you're talking about a vacant house. Kansas City is a place with a lot of vacant lots, vacant buildings, and yes, vacant homes. What can an artist's role in that be?
As with how do you eat an elephant in the room? I mean, how do you eat an elephant, rather? I'm sorry.
It would be convenient if the elephant was in the room. If you wanted to eat it.
Okay, I'm sure. Okay, I know we're short on time this morning. So one bite at a time. How is it that you can contribute as an artist, as an individual, as a corporation? Start off by having a conversation and with the people that you're trying to interact with.
Sean, we've just heard an example, I mean, of someone being really just participating in a long, steady process that involves a lot of active participation from people who have been in a neighborhood for a long time. Are there examples of people going into neighborhoods that don't mirror what was just described? Can you give an example that would be maybe the bad example
in
your view?
I mean, apparently the Lawrence Art Center's project in Lawrence, Kansas right now is being contested because they didn't have neighborhood buy-in.
What project is that?
I think the Lawrence Art Center got a creative placemaking grant from Arts Place America, which is kind of leading these practices and projects. I've only heard from the artist side of that in East Lawrence, so I'm not an expert, obviously, and we are short on time, so I'm obviously leaving out a lot. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, there's a lot, you could say Cordish Company and P&L is a prime example of like a top-down kind of financially backed by the city approach of how to do development wrong because it's bankrupt, right? And then at the same time, you have Crossroads, which the city didn't really touch at all other than giving it a tax abatement in 2006, is like a prize gem now, right?
Let's consider the Crossroads. I mean, how do you both see what's happened over there in the last 15, 20 years? I'll start with you, Sean, and then I'd love to get Pat's take.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that the city is a process, and we're in a process of learning, especially in Kansas City. And I think tax abatements are huge when we're talking about any of this. I know for a fact that like Ivanhoe has a, if you're a first-time home buyer, you get a 10-year tax abatement on your property. Those are what are going to keep people in those neighborhoods when development kind of comes along. So for me, I think we need to start there. And the Crossroads did that in 2006 when all that stuff was coming up. Now the streetcar is coming through and the abatement is up for renewal. So it will be really interesting to see how the city deals with that.
Pat, what's your take on how you've seen the Crossroads change over the last 15, 20 years?
That we have forgotten the term corporate social responsibility, which was popular in the 70s. I'm a corporation. I am coming into a particular area. And what I need to do is to find out how it is that I can contribute to the surrounding neighborhoods. And again, once again, talk to your customers, talk to the neighborhood, find out how it is that you can assist as you're moving forward. We cannot play this game with profit being the only motivation any longer.
What is it that you've observed there specifically that makes you say this?
I was a victim. I had a gallery space in the East Crossroads, and the landlord had to raise rent, and so I had to move. And so it's very simple as to what happens.
Do you think that the way the rest of the city experiences the Crossroads is affected by people like you who had spaces there once not being there? Like, what is different about the Crossroads we know than it might have been if you and people like you were still there?
I think that we need to reexamine policies, touching back on what Sean was saying. We need to look at tax abatement issues. We need to look at beginning new programs like the city and Megan Krieger have. Megan is our new director of creative services.
For the city?
For the city. And there is a new microloan program for artists that she is spearheading.
And that makes a difference. I mean, could you spell out how giving microloans directly to artists is different from, say, having an initiative with arts organizations?
It allows people to... It helps them to become more self-sustaining and allows them to better be equipped to stay in their place, which is what we want to happen in neighborhoods. We want people to age in place if they so desire, and we want people who want to stay in their houses to be able to stay in their houses.
There's kind of this interesting tension, though. I mean, people moving in and out of places and making their mark on those places is just part of living in like a mobile society. We aren't tethered to the spots where we were born. The idea that the only people who have a say in the future of the place are the ones who have been there forever can sound a little provincial. How do we embrace what's already in a place without that provincialism? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's a different kind of integration. I think we're talking about not just racial integration or economic types of integration, but we have to redefine what that means. Certainly, we don't want the Northeast to lose its historical cultural value. We don't want 18th and Vine to lose its historical cultural value. So we need to have a discourse about how we do that.
Well, I would say that the ones with capital are the ones that are that have a say. I would say that we're trying to argue that there definitely needs to be a process in which we learn how to understand that the people that have made the neighborhood appealing need to stay there because they're the ones that did the legwork. I think that's the issue that I have with the whole, like, you know, oh, just because they've been there the longest, they deserve a say. It's also because they put the work in. I mean, capital is easy to kind of dump, you know, into investment, into things. So for me, it's about the process of engagement that we have that allows for a more, you know, like what Pat said, an integrated approach so that you're not necessarily going to get everybody to buy in, but at least everybody's invited to that table to have that kind of conversation. And I think it's one of those things that right now the city is kind of going through this identity crisis, trying to appeal to that Richard Florida argument of, you know, talent attraction and all of these kinds of things. And we're going to lose the luster that we've had here for a long time if we're not careful.
You have, I picked up from the article, a little bit of a bone to pick with the term creatives.
Mm-hmm.
That you, and that's part of this idea that you're trying to attract creatives. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot wrong with Richard Florida. So for me, it's just this idea that, like, well, his thesis is that there's this group of people, this economic income group that is the creative class that are interested in chic coffee shops and all this stuff and diversity and ethnic diversity and all of these things. And then they come into these neighborhoods and they're interested in, and basically the problem with his thesis is, like, if you're touring to all these different cities with a book that talks about a creative class index and you're rating cities, your book sales are going to go astronomical in each city if you rate them higher. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that, you know, his arguments fall short because it's not necessarily about this kind of, there isn't a class. It's more about that there's this kind of cultural appropriation that happens through individuals that are artists or that are integrated into their own community. And I think that's another fallacy with it. And, you know, I know we're short for time, so I can't really get into it too much. But, you know, for me, it's about, I think we need to struggle a little more with language. And I think we need to be a little more nuanced. That's why I have a problem with creative placemaking, is it's a Band-Aid approach rather than a kind of more organic, unique kind of neighborhood scale. And I think that's what Pat and I were talking about earlier, is we're interested in how to empower neighborhoods on their own unique identity rather than, hey, this worked in this neighborhood, it's got to work here, because that's not how neighborhoods work.
Yeah, that brings me to the question of, what do we miss in Kansas City when we talk about development and progress in urban neighborhoods and how arts fit into that?
Bringing the little people to the table. I mean, I go to meetings all the time where, you know, there are CEOs and presidents of companies, but the customer base is not at the table. And so I think one of the first steps is to bring folks in and then figure out how it is, once again, that you can work to empower them.
So what advice would you guys give specifically to artists as they try to make their own just personal, independent decisions about the projects they take on and how they go about it?
Do their homework and read a lot, because I know a lot of artists don't in this kind of process. And then also learn to listen. That's the fundamental flaw that a lot of us have, is that we have this top-down approach because we are the creative types, right? So for me, it's about active listening.
Don't assume anything. Take some of that creative energy and bring it along with you at the boardroom table.
Well, our time is up for today's Central Standard, but this is a subject we will come back to in a lot of different ways. So stay in touch and let us know about any and all developments that should be on our radar. You can email tips to centralstandard@kcur.org or talk to us on Twitter. We're @KCURCST. Sean Starowitz, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sean co-authored an article with Julia Cole on creative placemaking for Lumpin' Magazine. We'll link to it online. And Pat Jordan, I really appreciate your time, taking the time to be here. It's been
great.
My
pleasure. Thank you.
Today's conversations will be available online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll hear about the sour beer trend, and we'll also catch up a little bit on Midtown history. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Thanks to Sam Zeff for providing sound today from Clay Como Ford. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's a wrap. Stick around for Up to Date with Steve Kraske, coming up next.